And so the companies came and were hailed and cheered and passed through the gate. Men of the outlands marching to defend the city of Gondor in a dark hour, but always too few, always less than hope looked for or need asked. Return of the King. Welcome to the first official episode of the Grey Company podcast. Today we're talking Outlands. This trait was unleashed with the Steward's Fear, which was the first adventure pack of the Against the Shadow cycle, and it's since taken on a life of its own. So in this episode, we'll be discussing the Outlands trait, its strengths and weaknesses, how it's affected the game so far, what its effect could be in the future. Love it or hate it, it's time for Outlands.
Welcome everyone, it's episode 01 of the Grey Company Podcast. My name is Derek, and I'd like to start by saying thank you to everyone who listened to the pilot episode and gave us all kinds of encouraging feedback. Everyone over there on the FFG forums and the Board Game Geek forums and Facebook and Reddit, all corners of the LOTR LCG community. You guys have been great, so we appreciate that. So here today we have our usual assemblage of the Grey Company. Dan, how are you doing today?
Good. So since the last episode, I've just been trying to work on a unique Outlands deck, and that's something I look forward to talking about today. How about you, Ian? What's up with you?
Well, hello everyone. I'm good. I finally found a Lord of the Rings player in my area, so that's exciting, actually getting to play with someone fairly regularly in person. As far as what I've been playing, mostly been playing against the Black Riders and banging my head up against the wall of Nightmare Escape from Dol Guldur. Matthew, how are you doing?
Oh, I'm doing well, thanks. Since the last show, I played with my local organized play group, and I think, Derek, you inspired me to build a Dúnhir Dagger of Westernese deck, and it actually performed really well, and I liked it a lot.
Were you able to get the double dagger on him?
Yes, and I was playing with a leadership partner, and he doesn't have all of the expansions, but he had a lot of cards that I wouldn't normally use, but he was using things like Fresh Tracks and a few other leadership tricks to keep enemies in the staging area, and it actually was a great partner deck to my deck, so it was a lot of fun.
Excellent.
Yeah.
Well, we're going to get right into it. Today we're talking Outlands. As Ian said in the introduction, Outlands started in the exploded with the Steward's Fear adventure pack. It actually began with the Heirs of Numenor box. We're going to be having a look today at the Outlands trait and discussing how it works and, really more importantly, its impact on the game. So, Matthew, why don't you give us a quick overview of how the trait works for those of us who may not know?
Sure. So Outlands is a trait on various hero or ally cards, and basically they all pump up the others. Other card games have used this mechanic. I believe it's Slivers in Magic the Gathering, though I didn't play during that time period. But basically, one Outlands character is boosting hit points. The other is boosting all Outlands willpower. The other is boosting attack strength or defense strength. So again, basically they all boost one another. We've also gotten a few Outlands attachments and events and things like that that also just make them crazy powerful. So basically, unlike the dwarves, which don't necessarily boost the statistics of each other up, the Outlands are pretty much making each other Outlands character beefier and beefier.
Okay, well, let's go ahead and get started. I guess my first question to you guys is, how does this affect the metagame? And when we talk about metagame, we mean kind of the overall picture of where the game is going and how it works and the cards that are being produced and all that kind of thing. So what do you guys think? Is it good for the metagame overall?
I would say it's mixed. It's good in the sense that I think before Outlands, for anyone who was new to the game, let's say they picked up Heirs of Numenor, those, like, Into Ithilien and Siege of Carandros, and even the first scenario in that box can be really challenging, especially if all you've got is the core set and Heirs of Numenor. So I think in that sense, having a really powerful archetype that doesn't require a lot of cards is good, but on the other hand, I really think Outlands is too powerful. So I think it has a negative effect on the overall metagame because it skews things to be more difficult, which is kind of ironic given that it was introduced to be friendly to new players.
Right.
Yeah, if I'm going to say anything positive about Outlands, and I don't think I'll be all that positive this episode, I will say I like sort of the distribution of the cards during this cycle more so than other cycles. So basically, most of the needed cards to build an Outlands deck come in the Steward Sphere Adventure Pack. Yeah, there was one Outlands ally in Heirs of Numenor, and there's been events or whatever in other adventure packs, but basically you needed one, and all you needed was Steward Sphere to build a great deck. The second adventure pack of this cycle was mostly the Monosphere card. So they've really been sort of compartmentalizing the cards, I think, in this cycle, which I like. So in that sense, you buy one adventure pack, you've got a deck, you're good to go. To me, that's pretty much the only positive about the Outlands. I'll probably save a lot of my specific criticisms when we're getting a little more into it. So I guess I could agree with Dan and say mixed, but overall I would say no, it's absolutely not a good development for the game.
Well, let's talk about that for a second. If I'm a new player and I'm trying to get into this game and I go on Board Game Geek or something and somebody recommends that I pick up the core set, of course, Heirs of Numenor, and then the Steward Sphere. I'm going to get a winning deck right out of the box, like you guys are talking about. So that's going to make me want to get more invested into the game, which could push me to try new and different kinds of deck archetypes. So is it positive in that sense, or is that setting the bar too high, maybe?
I mean, for me, that's kind of something people say often, that Outlands is beneficial to new players, which it is and it isn't. In one sense, it is that, like Matthew said, you can just get Steward Sphere and be pretty much good to go. I think it's good in the sense that if you're new to the game, people get really frustrated and kind of get beat by the same quest over and over. So Outlands gives you kind of a way of getting into the game, learning the game, the phases, all that kind of stuff without getting too overwhelmed. On the other hand, though, I wonder how good it is for new players. Are you really going to be building your deck building skills and your strategy skills when you have this deck that kind of just plays itself?
That's a very good point.
Well, just we're talking about how they're, you know, all in one, almost, you know, a player deck in a box with that Steward Sphere expansion pack that can beat many, if not most, scenarios. Well, just how powerful are they? Are they? Because some people have said they're not quite as powerful as everyone is making them up to be. So how powerful are they just as a deck type?
It's hard to generalize because there's some very unique scenarios in this game. But they can be really tremendously powerful, and especially with the right draw. There's two critical allies in the archetype, the Anphalus Herdsman and the Aether Swordsman. And if you get those guys out early, pretty much any Outlands deck will crush most scenarios. So yeah, it's a very, very powerful archetype.
Yeah, we were talking sort of before we began recording the show that when the Steward Sphere pack came out, there was someone on some forum, so sorry we can't give you a proper shout-out, but he was playing with just one hero, Hirolyn the Fair, the Outlands hero, against pretty much, I think, every existing quest, and he beat the vast majority of them with a solo hero and the Outlands. So certainly secrecy might have been a factor there. The threat was really low, so enemies weren't engaging for a while. But once he was able to get established, I suppose, with his allies, he was able to beat almost every quest. And to me, that's just, it's poor game design, lack of foresight, and I can't see how these really are a positive development for the game.
Yeah, they're super powerful. I know there have been people who say they don't think it's that powerful. But for me, I use the Outlands deck against Nightmare version of A Conflict at the Carrick, which is one of the tougher scenarios, and just demolished it. Like, the trolls were just crying in a corner by the end of it because they just got smashed to pieces, you know? So, I mean, people are entitled to their opinion, but their one weakness is maybe they just start out a little slow, maybe. But it's fairly easy to kind of build around that and just get them going. And after that, they're just unstoppable.
Yeah, and I don't even know that I would say they start out slow. They start out fragile.
Mm-hmm.
Because,
true.
I mean, even dwarves kind of start out slow until you can get, like, the, you know, Feely Keely combo going where you get the five dwarf threshold. But, yeah, you're definitely vulnerable in the first couple rounds. But once you get one of those key allies, Outlands just starts running. And especially if you have any kind of card draw. Yeah, you're definitely right. The first two rounds are critical, but I don't even feel like it's slow because it's so cheap. That's the other thing I think to me that makes it so powerful is if each of those allies cost one more, then maybe it wouldn't be as imbalanced. But when you're dropping for one an ally that'll have better stats than most heroes, it really gets kind of ridiculous.
Yeah, I was just going to make that point. I am no game designer, so I certainly couldn't do Caleb or Matt's job or Lucas before them. And Lucas is the one who designed this particular cycle of cards. But I would have costed them all at two. And all of their stats would have been 0-0-0. Some of them cost 1 and their stats are 0-0-0 or whatever. Some of them cost 2 and they're 1-1-1s. But I would have made them all at least 2 and 0-0-0. Because they still get buffed up quite a bit to be solid 2s or even 3s. So yeah, I think that's part of their power, is their cheap cost, Hirulin's ability to pay for allies of any sphere, and then some of them starting off with some ones as their statistics. So yeah, that's part of the issue for me as well.
Yeah, that's a good point you bring up, Matthew, that I was thinking about as well, is that they are very undercosted. They're either one or two. And I can see why they did that, because the whole strategy of Outlands is just to pump out this army, but that's what makes them overpowered in a sense. So I wonder, just raising the cost, or maybe if there was like an increasing cost as you get more Outlands out, that the cost of them rises, which would maybe be more thematic in the sense that it was really hard in the books to scrape this Outlands army together. You know, it wasn't something that they just, all the areas of Gondor just pumped them out quickly. It was something where it was like every last scraping, every last person that they could get there.
Sure. Perhaps Hirulin could have paid for allies of any sphere, but if they weren't leadership, his natural sphere, he had to pay one more or something.
Yeah. And even getting into it a little bit on the thematic side, like you're talking about, if that's a thematic choice that this army is just going to be arriving from the Outlands. Another way they could have played it is, you know, Matthew, you mentioned making them a little more expensive or having them all start at zeros, which would have been one way. But looking at it from a little bit of a more of a thematic perspective, I think it would have been really cool if they had maybe limited the boosts to unique allies. Like in the books, they talk about the other captains of the Outlands, like Duin here and his sons, Duilin and Darifin and Dervori and Golaskil, all these guys from the different parts of the Outlands. You could have had one of those would be plus one spirit to all Outlands characters. And the next guy could have been plus one hit point to all Outlands characters. And that way it's less.
Good.
Yeah, and you could have even let them keep the Gondor trait. And so those general global Gondor effects could have had more potency, especially like poor Boromir, who was kind of like the spotlight of the Heirs expansion, and then he got kicked to the side because Baragon was so good and Outlands outnumbered him. So there were different ways they could have handled it that might have even been even more thematic. And then you maybe could have had like a general Outland soldier or something who also got the boosts. But the only named unique allies or characters even that they have are Hirulin, who we already talked about, and then, of course, good old Fat Forlong, who's just insane. Can you guys talk about him for a minute and just I mean, is it too much to say that he's game-breaking?
He's absurd. Being able to, for example, exhaust him to pay for a very good tale and then have him ready and then quest with him and then have him ready and then defend with him is, it's completely ridiculous, that card.
But at the same time, you need to have all four colors of Outlands out, so does that make it a little more balanced, or is that...
I mean, if you're saying... Yeah, so his ability doesn't work until maybe about round 3, maybe 4.
Right.
I mean, but the ability itself is so good that... And it's one of those combinatorial kind of things. Like, on its own, you look at it and go, oh, he readies at the beginning of every phase, no big deal. But when his stats are, 3 willpower, 2 defense, and 3 attack, or something ridiculous like that, being able to use him for multiple things is, he really becomes better than a hero at that point.
Right. My play experience with Outlands is limited. Mitch, who I did the progression series with, I think tried Outlands in a few of our later videos. And when I was at Gen Con, I was playing with some guys, and one of them was using Outlands, and I gave him nothing but shit for that. But anywho, you know, when Mitch was using Forlong, I remember Mitch not having all of the allies out. He had lots of card draw and this and that and the other, but he, for whatever reason, wasn't drawing the allies he needed. They were stuck at the bottom of the deck. So Forlong, I think, might have gotten his ability later on in the game, but Mitch, you know, one thing, he would forget to ready him during certain phases, and Lord knows I probably would. But it's one of those things where I see what you're saying, Derek, in that if for whatever reason one of your Outlands allies happens to be, like the Tactics one, for example, happens to be stuck at the bottom of your deck, and you're just not drawing it, then Forlong isn't as good as he otherwise would be. But provided you have a lucky draw, thank God Forlong's unique. But yeah, he's quite a powerful ally.
And for me, if we're really going to talk about the Outlands card that I think is super overpowered, it's Men of the West.
Absolutely.
The biggest weakness of Outlands was the fact that they are fragile, as Dan said. They start off with one hit point, they can be killed off. And if you're using card effects and card draw that discards cards, maybe you mess up and your allies end up in your discard pile. So that was their one big weakness, which is good. Every trait should have at least one big weakness. And then Men of the West comes along, and it just takes away that weakness completely. You can just pay one resource for each Outlands ally in your discard pile and get them back in your hand. I think that was the single card that really turned me against Outlands hardcore. I was kind of ambivalent about them before, but when this card came out, I was like, they earned my ire after that.
yeah, totally. For me, it was a combination of that card and the Lord of Morthond was one other kind of gap in the archetype that I thought was appropriate, which was card draw. And they basically took two of the big gaps and just plugged them and said, here you go, let's fill those in.
Well, just to play devil's advocate, you know, everything we're basically saying is that the Outlands is a very powerful, self-contained deck type that doesn't require a lot of forethought or strategy. However, this is a cooperative game. There is kind of a competitive aspect that some people engage in, but not really. So ultimately, what's the big deal? I think a lot of people would say to themselves, so what? So what if there's this perhaps overpowered deck type? What does it matter if it's not a lot of tournament play happening or anything like that?
Right. This gets a transition there, Derek, because this gets to the thought my biggest beef with Outlands is not Outlands in and of itself, but it has to do with playtesting and the creation of future scenarios. In that, if Outlands are so good, and FFG does have playtesters, sometimes they get flack for their scenarios not being playtested, but I know that they do have playtesters, and these quests do get playtested. If playtesters are using Outlands, whether it's Hirulyn solo or Hirulyn combined with other characters, because Outlands have proven to stomp almost every existing quest within a couple of turns, with low threat, hardly any damage, as Ian was saying, and all of that, it means that any quest that is going to be designed in the future, if it's being playtested by Outlands, or whatever the high power deck happens to be a year or 2 years from now, it just means that the scale of the quests get exponentially more difficult. Now, to be fair, I think that the card pool and power creep is a real issue, and so quests are going to sort of naturally evolve towards being more difficult. But if you're playtesting with a certain trait in mind that's always going to win and wins in a couple of turns, provided it gets going, I think that's a dangerous sort of path to tread down. And so I just sort of see Outlands not being bad in and of itself, like I said, or inherently bad, but I see it bad about in how it could potentially influence the design of future quests. And in that sense, I'm really, really leery of them.
Well, can they not? Is it impossible to correct without taking Outlands into account? Or is it possible to put Outlands in kind of a vacuum and say, oh, well, that's just kind of a worst case scenario? Is that possible?
That's hard. That's really hard. I mean, it'll be interesting to see how the new scenarios, you know, look with, like, the future Saga expansions and with the upcoming, you know, Deluxe, the Voice of Isengard, I want to say it's called. But I'm totally with Matthew on this, and there's a subtle difference between power creep and excessive power creep, because I think that I think power creep is not only inevitable, but it's actually a good thing, because if they only released cards, player cards, that were weaker or equal to existing cards, the card pool would start to stagnate and the game would get kind of boring. So power creep to a point is okay and is even healthy, because that's how you get new people interested and you mix things up and your older cards that weren't relevant suddenly, like, you know, a great example is Dunehir wasn't really a big thing, and then you see Dagger Western S, which is a tremendously powerful card, and suddenly you've got a new archetype that just springs up out of nowhere. So power creep's okay. It's the rate of power creep that really concerns me, and that's exactly what you're talking about, Matthew, which is when you have an archetype that is that much better. I mean, all my other really good decks, playing those against Nightmare, Escape from Dol Guldur, playing 4 or 5 times and barely winning once. You know, this is with really good, like, Frodo, Glorfindel, Aragorn decks. And then playing Outlands and just stomping it.
The power creep issue is interesting, because I'm just thinking about the current Against the Shadow cycle, and I think for a lot of players, when Heirs of Numenor, the expansion, came out, everyone was just kind of taken aback a little bit and thinking, well, this game suddenly got really hard, and people were complaining a lot about power creep. But in general, I'd have to say that the actual cycle, which is what Outlands is part of, has been, I always hesitate to call things easy, but fairly on the easy side, other than maybe the Druidan Forest is the one I would put aside. I don't know if you guys disagree with me or not, but like the cycle that Outlands is part of, we haven't seen that really impact the power level that much, it seems like.
Yeah, and Druidan is especially difficult multiplayer. The more players, it's an interesting one, the more players you add, the harder it gets.
I think the only point of comparison right now is Dwarves and the Dwaradelv cycle versus Outlands and the Against the Shadow cycle. And for me, I think you're, it's not as much fun to agree, but I actually think you're spot on, Ian, in that some of those Dwaradelv quests were so difficult. We, in the previous, or previously, we had talked about some of our favorite scenarios, and a number of us really liked Foundations of Stone. That's a great quest, but that's a really hard quest. And even if you had a good dwarf deck kicking, at that point, it was still really, really challenging, at least for me. I don't think the dwarves really became as powerful as they are until more of the cards came out from the Saga expansions. So thinking of the dwarves within strictly the Dwaradelv cycle, I would say, yeah, that the Against the Shadow is definitely a little bit easier.
What I will say, I feel like what's happened in this cycle and perhaps in the Hobbit boxes a little bit, is there's been a little more anti-ally cards coming off the encounter deck. I can't think of a ton off the top of my head, but the one I can think of is Knife in the Back. Is that what it's called? Where the highest attack power ally or whatever.
Gandalf tries to kill Aragorn.
Yeah, stabs your hero, and then that ally goes away. So certainly that could mess with Outlands potentially, other than you've got Men of the West. But I feel like there's been other sort of cards that punish you for allies. There's the ones where you remove a certain, you know, all the spheres from the quest. I think that's the Hobbit box, actually, so that's pre-Outlands. But, you know, there's a lot of things that really mess with having a lot of allies, or a lot of attachments, or all sorts of things that people sort of try and do. And so in that sense, again, getting at sort of future quest design and those sorts of things, are we going to start seeing a lot of ally hate or ally weeding out to compensate for things, decks like the Outlands that are so dependent? In fact, they're entirely dependent on getting allies on the table. We may not. I really trust Caleb, and I think the Saga expansions have been better than, personally speaking, the past two cycles. And so I'm really excited for and the Saga expansions have been developed solely by Caleb. This cycle was by Lucas prior to Caleb, so I really like the way Caleb is taking the game, and so I have faith that he and Matt will manage it well, but it's certainly, I think, something to be aware of, and I'm sure that they are.
Yeah, and I can give you a great example of exactly what you're talking about. I agree, by the way. Black Riders is an awesome expansion. Really, really well designed, a lot of replay value, so kudos to Caleb and Matthew on that one. The best example of what you're talking about, though, is actually in Black Riders. There's, in the first scenario, I want to say it's stage 2, you actually get penalized for each ally you have in play. Right. Your hide tests are one more difficult. Right. So in an Outlands deck, right. you actually just made your, you potentially made your hide test impossible to pass at that point, unless you're holding all your guys back for the hide test.
Well, part of the, a challenge that we'd kind of issued for ourselves for this episode was creating some interesting decks within the Outlands cycle. Something we've talked about is that the Outlands is just maybe a little bit bland. And so we challenged ourselves to come up with some interesting decks. Before we do that, are there some maybe general deck building decisions that you guys make to go along with the Outlands cards when you're actually building an Outlands deck? Are there any go-to cards for those few as they are, those areas where Outlands are lacking?
Well, card draw is basically number one. You can't, I've tried it, you can't really have a very effective Outlands deck without good card draw. So pretty much if you're doing mono leadership, you're going to do Lord of Morthond. If not, I find you pretty much need to throw in lore so you can get access to something like Expert Treasure Hunter or some of those other card draw effects. So that's kind of priority number one for an Outlands deck, I think.
Yeah, I totally agree with that. One of the things that I did just to make my deck a little bit different is rather than use card draw as a way to get at the critical allies, I like to call it ally mustering. There's a couple different events in leadership that are not strictly card draw, but they have the intended effect, which is to get the Outlands allies, particularly the herdsmen and the swordsmen, into play. So I built a secrecy deck using Biffer with a King Under the Mountain for some traditional card draw, but then also I used Very Good Tale and Timely Aid to really, like, as mentioned before, those first couple rounds where the deck can be fragile, you really want to get that herdsman out before you see any kind of ally hate. So you're basically hunting for it early on, was the idea. But yeah, if you're not gonna do something clever like that, you're absolutely right, Ian. You need card draw because, as Matthew mentioned, you know, if you don't get to those critical allies, then yeah, Outlands can sputter and die. It's just typically it doesn't do that if you've got a deck with enough card draw.
And I suppose the flip side of that is, what Outlands cards, if any, work well in non-Outlands decks?
Well, that I can comment on, because I've actually done it. I've used the Aether Swordsman in regular decks, non-Outlands decks, because the Aether Swordsman's the spirit version, the willpower-boosting ally. And so basically, he costs 2, and you're getting 2 willpower for a cost of 2. And if you happen to get more of them out, then I think, you know, then he's willpower 3 or 4. So I think that one's pretty good. I think you could also potentially do Knights of the Swan, because that would boost his attacks. He could get up to be the tactics ally. He could get up to potentially 3 attack for a cost of 1, which is fantastic. But outside of those two, boosting defense isn't all that great. I think Defender of Ramaz does that just fine. And the Onfalos Herdsman, if you're not using other Outlands, then you certainly don't need to be boosting hit points. So for me, Aether Swordsman takes the cake, and I will thank Mitch for teaching me that lesson. I was so resistant to Outlands, I refused to use them, and he convinced me to do it once, so thank you, Mitch. But then I do think that Knights of the Swan could find a home in certain decks.
Yeah, I 100% agree with Matthew. I've kind of toyed around with the idea that maybe if you're going to use either of those, maybe it might be worth it to throw the Sword of Morthond in there for 1. So say if you had a couple of Aether Swordsmen, you throw Sword of Morthond onto someone like, I'm trying to think of a worthwhile Gondor ally. Faramir, sure.
Would Denethor be worth it, or is his little willpower loss, is that too much to count on?
It could be worth it depending on what deck you're running. But just those couple cards together, you could get one ally really powerful. But I don't know, I would be a little bit scared that I wouldn't get the swordsman out or the sword out, and it would just kind of take up space in my deck.
Yeah, that's one of the things thematically that I find kind of frustrating about the archetype is that it really exists on an island in a sense. Which is kind of ironic, you know. Our opening quote from the books is all about the interaction, you know, and all the peoples coming to the defense of Gondor. And it's weird that the archetype does not really interact with Gondor at all. I mean, you could say that the sword it does, but it's very minimal. and very conditional in that sense. I kind of wish that they had done something like what Outlands was between Gondor and Rohan. I mean, obviously it couldn't be like what Outlands actually is, or it would be too powerful, but something like that, where the idea that the whole is greater than the sum of its parts. But it's, yeah, because Outlands kind of came out of left field, and it's, yeah, never really sat right with me thematically or strategically.
In one way, I don't know if they had this in mind when they were creating the archetype, but I guess you could try to justify it by seeing the men of Minas Tirith as being kind of set apart a little bit, in that that's where the seat of the steward is, and it eventually becomes the capital again when Aragorn takes his place as king. So the impression you get from the book is that even though Forlong and Hirluin and all these guys, and Imrahil, of course, who we didn't really talk about that much, might have to come back to him, they all come from these outlands to Gondor, they're actually leaving the vast majority of their men in the outlands to defend against the corsairs who are coming up out of the south. So I guess you could kind of think about it that way thematically, in that, yes, they're Gondorian and they're there to help, but they're not really willing to commit everything to the cause of Minas Tirith. They're not going to let their homes burn while Minas Tirith is defended. So I don't know if maybe that's a long shot, but that's one way to think about it. But you're probably right. There's if they are going to be these Gondorian soldiers, they should probably contribute a little bit more to maybe the Gondor trait, or have more interaction with the Gondor cards than just the Sword of Morthond.
Well, we have one adventure pack to go, so there you go. The cycle, so who knows what's in store.
A unique ally that gives all Gondor characters the Outlands trait.
Oh, jeez.
Win.
play this card to win.
Yeah.
Right.
That's going to be the flavor text. Play this card to win. So, like I said, we challenged ourselves to come up with some interesting Outlands decks. So let's go ahead and start with you, Dan. What was your deck, and how interesting were you able to make it, if at all?
Okay, I'm not going to go through a full deck list, but basically it was Secrecy with Hirluin and Biffer, the lore hero from the Khazad Dûm expansion. And it featured all the usual suspects as far as Outlands allies go, and Forlong, and even a couple copies of Hunter of Lamadon. And then basically the whole rest of the deck was some resource acceleration, obviously Steward of Gondor, and then the tricks that I mentioned earlier, Timely Aid and A Very Good Tale, and even Sneak Attack. The whole idea of the deck, though, was basically just to get to the swordsmen and the herdsmen as quickly as possible, because I basically have found with playing this deck that if you can get those out early, you're usually going to win. So just cut to the chase, don't really worry about anything, any other strategic elements. It kind of makes it a little bit more one-dimensional to play, but it is interesting the first couple rounds, because that's really what, you know, it's all about can you dig and get to those cards and get them into play quickly.
Yeah, speaking of one-dimensional play, my idea was to go back to the old Rohan Rush deck, where you just kind of blaze through the quest, relying mostly on willpower, and the one dimension of Outlands, and the gripe that many of us have had, is that there's no nuance. You have your guys who are there to quest, and they do it exceedingly well. Then you have your guys there to defend, and they do it really well. You have your guys there to attack, and they kill everything. And then you just ready everybody and begin again. So my thinking was, well, I'll change it up a little bit, and we'll have some of the Rohan strategy where things are coming and leaving play, and you have a lot of willpower and things like that. So I went with Eowyn and Theodred and Hirluin. So you have some resource generation from Theodred. You have the insane questing of Eowyn. You have other Rohan cards to kind of complement the questing aspect. And then you have some supplementary cards to push everything besides questing out of the way. So there were some Lights in the Dark to push enemies away. There was, of course, Tests of Will for cancellation, and lots of resource generation. But what I found I actually did was I just added to the problem. It was just Outlands deck with more questing power. So it didn't get that interesting. There was some stuff like I threw in Valiant Sacrifice to get a little bit of card draw because Rohan guys are going to be leaving. And I actually left out the Herdsmen just because there wasn't room in the deck. Initially, I had him in, but I had to take him out because I got through something like Passage Through Mirkwood. I couldn't finish it because I didn't have enough attack power to kill Ungoliant Spawn, or even getting through basically any quest that had any kind of boss thing at the end. I was screwed because there was no way to generate enough attack strength to kill anybody. So I got rid of the Herdsman, and I put in Knights of the Swan, and once that was in there, it was ridiculous. I got through into Ithilien in, you know, single-digit rounds. And even though the attacking wargs popped up and was prepared to decimate my whole army because I didn't have the herdsmen in there, I luckily had a test of will in the chamber, and that canceled it, and we went on and saved the day. So that was my experience. Ian, how about you?
So my deck was an attempt to make Outlands interesting, for me at least. So I created a deck that I kind of ended up calling the Spearman Superhero deck. And the basic idea
that sounds
was...
amazing.
Well, I think the name is better than the actual deck. The basic idea was to use the Sword of Morthon, which is kind of the most interesting Outlands card to me, to give the Outlands trait to the Gondorian Spearman. So the Gondorian Spearman, every time it exhausts, it does 1 point of damage. So I gave the Sword of Morthon to him. And the idea was that the Spearman is awesome, but he only has one defense, one hit point. He's kind of weak. So I hope to get the Outlands allies into play and boost up the Spearman's defense and hit points to like 3 or 4 each. And then also attach a Spear of the Citadel to him, so he's doing 2 points of damage each time he defends. So it's a combo that I was able to pull off pretty often when playing. And that was the fun part of it. You know, having the Spearman that's pretty near indestructible that you can kind of just keep exhausting to defend over and over again, dealing direct damage to enemies. I used the card that I'm totally blanking on the name right now that readies a Gondor character, gives them +1 defense.
Oh, behind strong walls. Yeah.
Behind strong walls, so to get maximum use out of them. So all that was interesting. The problem was that it was just, I basically felt like I was just giving myself something to be entertained by while the Outlands machine just kind of did its thing in the background. And so,
are you not entertained, Ian? Are you not entertained?
Not really. As far as heroes, I used Thalin for some extra direct damage, Herluin and Elrond just to get those allies out quicker. So
that's funny.
That is the deck.
Awesome.
How about you, Matthew? What did you make?
So when I made my deck this week, my hero lineup was Baragon, Thalin, and Dúnhir. And yes, you heard me correctly, no Outlands in my deck, because that is way more fun to play. So I refused to play Outlands. I was not like Ian, where I was ambivalent. I was anti them from the second I picked up the Steward's Fear. I will never play them. I will never allow my buddies to use them when we're playing games, because I just find it completely, except for Mitch in the Progression Series, because we wanted to try it out, but, you know, on video. But I just find it completely boring. You know, I don't enjoy it. So I will never make one. So at least I don't think I will ever make one. Maybe, you know, there might be a quest in the future that's just so difficult that I must win it. But I'll break down and make Outlands. But yeah, it just doesn't fit my play style at all. I have no interest in it. And so I didn't make an Outlands deck this week.
Here's a homework assignment for any fans of this show that would like to make something fun, is we should have like a bumper sticker or a logo or something that says "Friends don't let friends play Outlands."
Oh, I love it. I love it. I love it. It can be our cover photo on the Facebook page.
Nice. So one of the things that really came across through this experiment for me in trying to make Outlands interesting is that you just can't, really, in my opinion anyway. Another homework assignment, if anyone wants to make an Outlands deck that actually makes me excited, but I don't think it's possible. But for me, the big problem is they don't have any special abilities. They just buff each other, that's about it. And so what is there to really do with them? They're just so vanilla to me. There's nothing, no decisions to make. Yep. Am I going to use this ability or this ability? They just quest, attack, defend. That's it.
Yeah, you hit the nail on the world. The nail. you hit the nail on the head there with the word decision. And that's part of the fun of this game in particular, is the decision making you have to do and addressing certain situations as they arrive from the encounter deck. It just doesn't really happen with the Outlands deck. So do we have any closing remarks, conclusions, or parting shots before we proceed here?
One thing that I would add, and I've actually, every once in a while on my blog, I'll rant about the metagame, and I think it was right before Outlands really hit it. It might have been right around the time that it came out, but I talked about the core set out-of-the-box experience, and I really feel like one of the big reasons why Outlands exists is because the core set, to me, is lacking in one way. And I should qualify this by saying I really love this game. It's an amazing game, but when I first bought it and just bought the core set and opened it up and played it, reading the rules and having it say, oh yeah, pick one of the Monosphere decks and, you know, 30 card decks and just shuffle it up and play it, that is traumatic. Especially if you happen to have chosen Tactics or really any of those decks can be very, very challenging, even against, you know, Passage Through Mirkwood, which is supposed to be an introductory scenario. So I really feel like Outlands kind of addresses that in one sense, but I really, really do wish that the core set was more oriented around factions or traits rather than spheres.
Yeah, you'll get no argument from me.
I really feel that would solve the issue to me, which is how do you introduce someone to this game? Which now the answer kind of is, you know, you've never played before, here's an Outlands deck. You can take it against pretty much any scenario, and you'll be able to learn the game. And as Ian mentioned, you're not necessarily going to make a lot of decisions, but that can be good for an introductory, you know, kind of a tutorial for the game. And then later you learn deck building and how to actually play cards that do things. So that's kind of, I guess, my apology for Outlands is that I see the gap that it fills within the game. I just wish that gap was filled in a different way.
It's interesting that you bring up building around, that you wish the core set built around traits rather than spheres. And this might be a whole new episode in and of itself, so I'll keep my thought brief. But I made an FFG thread a while back because I ran across a quote from Caleb, and I don't remember it at all, so I'd have to go back and find it. But it said something along the lines of, we don't design for traits or species of character, dwarf or elf or whatever. We design for
factions.
Spheres.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
That is his entire goal in the development of the game. So that's something interesting, and I actually appreciate it, but perhaps we'll save that for another show.
For me, I guess my final thought is I'm fine with spheres, factions, traits, whatever they want to emphasize. Decisions are everything. Just maximize those. Like, forget Boromir, Pippin, all those player types that they came up with. For me, I think of myself as a Captain Kirk kind of player, meaning I live for that feeling where you're stuck up against the wall. There's no hope. Looks like everything is lost, and then you find that perfect card combination or card play that's going to get you out of it. Like, I feel like that's so much of the enjoyment of the game for me, and Outlands doesn't give you anything in that department. And so whatever they want to focus on, as long as they can maximize those kind of those moments, those options, those decisions, then I'll be happy.
So we want more you catastrophe.
right.
So you're reprogramming the Kobayashi Maru scenario there with your decks.
Nice.
As for my final thought, I'm just going to echo Dan because it was so brilliant. Friends don't let friends play Outlands. And that's your final thought by Matthew.
Well, it's difficult to one-up on that. So, Dan, you want to tell the people how they can get in touch with us?
Yeah. So thanks again to everyone that's reached out on Facebook and on the blog, the WordPress blog. So you can find us at Grey Company Podcast. That's spelled with an E. That would be the Queen's English. Grey Company Podcast.wordpress.com. We're also on Facebook. You just search for the Grey Company Podcast. We've got our iTunes feed up now, so you should be able to go ahead and subscribe and use a feed reader or whatever your preferred means of consuming podcasts are. And we also, you can reach us by email, thegreycompanypodcast@gmail.com. Next episode, we've got deck building. It's part one of a multi-part discussion, and we might get into more of the or the topics that we touched on briefly tonight.
Boo Outlands. All right. Well, good night, everybody. Thank you for listening.
Night.
Well, we
did you just say totes?
Totes, man.
Oh,
sorry, I had to break the awkward silence.